Behind the desk was a huge policeman with an absolutely bald head, a big nose, and a prognathous jaw. He appeared to be 60 years old, at least. The men in rags were removing the handcuffs from the two prisoners. One of the young men in rags had on a thermal vest over a torn black T-shirt. He wore sneakers and dirty camouflage pants, tight at the ankles. There was a badge, a police shield, on the thermal vest. Then Sherman could see the other had a badge, too. Another old policeman came up to the desk and said, "Hey, Angel, Albany's down."
"Beautiful," said the man with the bald head. "We got this bunch and the shift just started."
Goldberg looked at Martin and rolled his eyes and smiled and then looked at Sherman. He still held Sherman by the elbow. Sherman looked down. Styrofoam peanuts. The styrofoam packing peanuts he had picked up in the back seat of Martin's car were all over the place. They were stuck to the wad of his jacket over his wrists. They were all over his tweed pants. His pants were wet, wrinkled, twisted shapelessly around his knees and his thighs, and the styrofoam peanuts clung to them like vermin. Goldberg said to Sherman,
"You see that room in there?"
Sherman looked over into a room through a large plate glass window. There were filing cabinets and piles of paper. A big beige and gray apparatus took up the center of the room. Two policemen were staring at it.
"That's the fax machine that sends the fingerprints to Albany," said Goldberg.
He said it in a pleasant sort of sing-song, the way you would say something to a child who is frightened and confused. The very tone terrified Sherman.
"About 10 years ago," said Goldberg, "some bright fella got the idea. Was it 10 years ago, Marty?"
"I don't know," said Martin. "All I know is it was a stupid fucking idea.
Anyway, somebody got the idea of putting all the fingerprints for the whole fucking state of New York in this one office in Albany. See? And then every one of the central bookings, they're wired into Albany, and you send the prints to Albany on the computer and you get back your report, and the suspect goes upstairs and gets arraigned, see? Only it's a frickin' log jam in Albany, especially when the machine goes down like right now."
Sherman couldn't take in a thing Goldberg was saying, except that something had gone wrong and Goldberg thought he was going out of his way to be nice and explain it.
"Yeah," Martin said to Sherman. "Be thankful it's 8:30 in the morning and not 4:30 in the fucking afternoon. If this was the fucking afternoon, you'd probably have to spend the night at the Bronx House of Detention, or even Rikers."
"Rikers Island?"
asked Sherman. He was hoarse. He barely got the words out.
"Yeah," said Martin. "When Albany goes down in the afternoon, forget about it. You can't spend the night in this place, so they take you over to Rikers. I'm telling you, you're very fortunate."
He was telling him he was very fortunate. Sherman was supposed to like them now. Inside here, they were his only friends. Sherman felt intensely frightened. Somebody yelled out,
"Who died in here, for Christ's sake?"
The smell reached the desk.
"Now that's disgusting," said the bald man called Angel. He looked around. "Hose it down!"
Sherman followed his eyes. Off to the side, down a corridor, he could make out two cells, white tiles and bars. They seemed to be constructed of white brick tiles, like a public bathroom. Two policemen stood in front of one of them. One of them yelled through the bars,
"What's the matter with you?"
Sherman could feel the pressure of Goldberg's huge hand on his elbow, steering him forward. He was in front of the desk, staring up at the Angel. Martin had a sheaf of papers in his hand. The Angel said,
"Name?"
Sherman tried to speak but couldn't. His mouth was utterly dry. His tongue seemed stuck to the roof of his mouth.
"Name?"
"Sherman McCoy."
It was barely a whisper.
"Address?"
816 Park Avenue, New York."
He added New York in the interest of being modest and obedient. He didn't want to act as if he just assumed people here in the Bronx knew where Park Avenue was.
Park Avenue, New York. Your age?
38.
Ever been arrested before?
No.
Hey, Angel, Martin said. Mr. McCoy here's been very cooperative, and, why don't you let him sit out here somewheres instead of putting him in there with that bunch of bats? The fucking so-called press out there, they gave him a hard enough time.
A wave of profound, sentimental gratitude washed over Sherman. Even as he felt it, he knew it was irrational, but he felt it, nonetheless. The angel puffed up his cheeks and stared off as if ruminating. Then he said,
"Can't do it, Marty."
He closed his eyes and lifted his huge chin upward as if to say, "The people upstairs."
What are they worrying about? The fucking TV virus has got him standing out there in the rain for a fucking half an hour. Look at him. Looks like he crawled in here through a pipe.
Goldberg chuckled. Then, so as not to offend Sherman, he said to him,
"You're not looking your best. You know that."
His only friends. Sherman wanted to cry, and all the more so because this horrible, pathetic feeling was genuine.
"Can't do it," said the angel. "Gotta do the whole routine."
He closed his eyes and lifted his chin again.
"You can take the cuffs off."
Martin looked at Sherman and twisted his mouth to one side. "Well, friend, we tried." Goldberg unlocked the handcuffs and took them off Sherman's wrists. There were white rings on his wrists where the metal had been. The veins on top of his hands were engorged with blood. "My blood pressure has gone through the roof." There were styrofoam peanuts all over his pants. Martin handed him his soggy jacket. Styrofoam peanuts all over the soggy jacket, too.
"Empty your pockets and hand me the contents," said the angel.
On the advice of Killian, Sherman hadn't brought much with him. $4 or $5 bills, about $1 in change, a key to the apartment, a handkerchief, a ballpoint pen, his driver's license. For some reason, he thought he should have identification. As he handed over each item, the angel described it aloud.
$20 in bills, one silver ballpoint pen,
and handed it to someone Sherman couldn't see. Sherman said,
"Can I keep the handkerchief?"
"Let me see it."
Sherman held it up. His hand was shaking terribly.
"Yeah, you can keep it, but you gotta give me the watch."
It's just a cheap watch," said Sherman.
He held up his hand. The watch had a plastic case and a nylon band.
"I don't care what happens to it."
"No can do."
Sherman undid the band and surrendered the little watch. A new spasm of panic went through him.
"Please," said Sherman.
As soon as the word left his mouth, he knew he shouldn't have said it. He was begging.
"How can I figure... Can I keep the watch?"
"You got an appointment or something?"
The angel attempted a smile to show he didn't mean it as much more than a pleasantry, but he didn't return the watch. Then he said,
"Okay, and I need your belt and your shoestrings."
Sherman stared at him. He realized his mouth was open. He looked at Martin. Martin was looking at the angel. Now Martin closed his eyes and lifted his chin the way the angel had and said,
"Ah, boy."
They really do have it in for him. Sherman unbuckled the belt and pulled it out of the loops. As soon as he did, the pants fell down around his hips. He hadn't worn the tweed suit in a long time, and the waist was much too big. He pulled the pants up and stuffed his shirt back inside, and they fell down again. He had to hold them up in front. He squatted down to take off the shoelaces. Now he was an abject creature crouched at the feet of Martin and Goldberg. His face was so close to the styrofoam peanuts on his pants, he could see the crinkles on them. Some sort of horrible beetles or parasites. The heat of his body and the woolly funk of the pants gave off an unpleasant odor. He was aware of the humid smell of his armpits under the clammy shirt. A total mess. No two ways about it. He had the feeling that one of them, Martin, Goldberg, the angel, would just step on him, and pop, that would be the end of that. He pulled out the shoestrings and stood up. Standing up from the crouch made him lightheaded. For an instant he thought he might faint. His pants were falling down again. He pulled them up with one hand and handed the angel the shoestrings with the other. They were like two little dried dead things. The voice behind the desk said,
"Two brown shoestrings." "Okay, angel," said Martin. "All yours."
"Right," said the angel.
"Well, good luck, Sherman,"
said Goldberg, smiling in a kindly fashion.
"Thanks," said Sherman. It was horrible. He actually appreciated it. He heard a cell door slide open. Down the little corridor stood three police officers herding a group of Latins out of one cell and into the one next to it. Sherman recognized several of the men who had been in line ahead of him outside.
"All right, knock it off and get in there."
"Mira! Mira!"
One man remained in the corridor. A policeman had him by the arm. He was tall, with a long neck, and his head lolled about. He seemed very drunk. He was muttering to himself. Then he threw his eyes to the heavens and screamed,
"Mira!"
He was holding up his pants the way Sherman was.
"Hey, Angel, what do I do with this one?"
"It's all over his pants."
The policeman said pants with great disgust.
"Well, shit," said the angel. "Take the pants off him and bury him, and then wash him off, too, and give him some of those green fatigues."
"I don't even want to touch him, Sarge. You got any of those things they take the cans off the shelf in the supermarket with?"
"Yeah, I got some," said the angel, "and I'm going to take your can off."
The policeman jerked the tall man back toward the first cell. The tall man's legs were like a marionette's. The angel said,
"What do you got all over your pants?"
Sherman looked down.
"I don't know," he said. "They were on the back seat of the car."
"Whose car?"
"Detective Martin's car."
The angel shook his head as if now he had seen everything.
"Okay, Tanooch, take him over to Gabsy."
A young white officer took Sherman by the elbow. Sherman's hand was holding up his pants, and so the elbow came up like a bird's wing. His pants were damp even in the waistband. He carried his wet jacket over his other arm. He started walking. His right foot came out of his shoe because the strings were gone. He stopped, but the policeman kept walking, jerking his elbow forward in an arc. Sherman put his foot back in the shoe, and the policeman motioned toward the little corridor. Sherman started shuffling so that his feet wouldn't come out of the shoes. The shoes made a squishing sound because they were so wet. Sherman was led toward the cubicle with the big windows. Now, just across the corridor, he could see inside the two cells. In one, there appeared to be a dozen figures, a dozen hulks of gray and black up against the walls. The door to the other was open. There was only one person inside, the tall man, slumped on a ledge. There was a brown mess on the floor. The odor of excrement was overpowering. The policeman steered Sherman into the cubicle with the windows. Inside was a huge, freckled policeman with a wide face and blonde, wavy hair who looked him up and down. The policeman called Tanooch, said,
"McCoy,"
and handed the big one a sheet of paper. The room seemed full of metal stands. One looked like the sort of metal detection gate you see at airports. There was a camera on a tripod. There was something that looked like a music stand, except that it had nothing at the top big enough to hold a page of music.
"Okay, McCoy," said the big policeman. "Step through that gate there."
Squish, squish, squish. Holding his pants up with one hand and holding his wet jacket in the other, Sherman shuffled through the gate. A loud whining beep came from the machine.
"Whoa, whoa," said the policeman. "Okay, give me a coat."
Sherman handed him the jacket. The man went through the pockets and then began kneading the jacket from top to bottom. He threw the jacket over the edge of a table.
"Okay, spread your feet and put your arms straight out to the side like this."
The policeman put his arms out as if he were doing a swan dive. Sherman stared at the policeman's right hand. He was wearing a translucent rubber surgical glove. It came halfway up his forearm. Sherman spread his feet. When he spread his arms, his pants fell way down. The man approached him and began patting down his arms, his chest, his ribs, his back, and then his hips and his legs. The hand with the rubber glove created an unpleasant dry friction, a new wave of panic. He stared at the glove in terror. The man looked at him and grunted, apparently in amusement, and then held up his right hand. The hand and the wrist were enormous. The hideous rubber glove was right in front of Sherman's face.
"Don't worry about the glove," he said. "The thing is, I gotta do your prints and I gotta pick your fingers up one by one and put them on the pad. You understand?"
His tone was conversational, neighborly, as if there were just the two of them, out by the alley, and he was explaining how the engine in his new Mazda worked.
"I do this all day, and I get the ink on my hands, and my skin's rough to begin with, and sometimes I don't get the ink all off, and I go home, and my wife has the whole living room done in white, and I put my hand down on a sofa or someplace, and I get up, and you can see three or four fingers on a sofa, and my wife throws a fit."
Sherman stared at him. He didn't know what to say. This huge, fierce-looking man wanted to be liked. It was also very odd. Perhaps they all wanted to be liked.
"Okay, walk on back through the gate."
Sherman shuffled back through the gate, and the alarm went off again.
"Shit," said the man. "Try it again."
The alarm went off a third time.
"Beats the hell out of me," said the man. "Wait a minute, come here. Open your mouth."
Sherman opened his mouth.
"Keep it open. Wait a minute, turn it this way. Can't get no light."
He wanted to move Sherman's head to a strange angle. Sherman could smell the rubber of the glove.
"Son of a bitch, you got a goddamn silver mine in there. I tell you what, bend over at the waist like this, try to get way down."
Sherman bent over, holding up his pants with one hand. Surely he wouldn't.
"Now back through the gate, but real slow."
Sherman started shuffling backward, bent over in an almost 90-degree angle.
"Okay, real slow, real slow, real slow. That's it. Whoa."
Sherman was now mostly through the gate. Only his shoulders and his head remained on the other side.
"Okay, back up, a little farther, a little farther, a little farther, a little farther."
The alarm went off again.
"Whoa, whoa, right there. Stay right there."
The alarm remained on.
"Son of a bitch," said the big man.
He began pacing around and sighing. He slapped his legs with his hands.
"I had one of these last year. Okay, you can stand up."
Sherman stood up. He looked at the big man, bewildered. The man stuck his head out the door and yelled,
"Hey, Tenoch, come here. Look at this."
Across the little corridor, a policeman was in the open cell with a hose washing down the floor. The rush of the water echoed off the tile.
"Hey, Tenoch!"
The policeman who had brought Sherman into the room came from down the corridor.
"Look at this, Tenoch," then he said to Sherman. "Okay, bend over and do that again. Back through the gate, real slow."
Sherman bent over and did as he was told.
"Okay, whoa, whoa, whoa. Now you see that, Tenoch? So far, nothing. Okay, now back up a little more, a little more, a little more."
The alarm went off. The big man was beside himself again. He paced about and sighed and put his hands together.
"D'you see that, Tenoch? It's his head. Swear to Christ, it's the fella's head. Okay, stand up. Open your mouth. That's it. Now, turn it this way."
He moved Sherman's head again to get more light.
"Look in there. You want to see some metal?"
The one called Tenoch said not a word to Sherman. He looked in his mouth like someone inspecting a crawl space in a cellar.
"Jesus Christ," said Tenoch. "You're right. Set of teeth look like a changemaker."
Then he said to Sherman, as if noticing him for the first time,
"They ever let you on an airplane?"
The big one cracked up over this.
"You're not the only one,"
he said.
I had one like you last year. Drove me out of my mind. I couldn't figure out what the fuck, you know?
Suddenly it was the casual fellow out back on Saturday mode of conversation again.
This machine is very sensitive, but you do have a whole head full of metal, I gotta tell you that.
Sherman was mortified, completely humiliated. But what could he do? Maybe these two, if he played along with them, could keep him out of the pens with those people. Sherman just stood there, holding up his pants.
"What's that stuff all over your pants?" asked Tanooch.
"Styrofoam," said Sherman.
"Styrofoam," said Tanooch, nodding his head, but in an uncomprehending fashion. He left the room.
Then the big man stood Sherman in front of a metal stand and took two pictures of him. One from the front and one from the side. It dawned on Sherman that this was what was known as a mug shot. This great huge bear had just taken his mug shot while Sherman stood there holding up his pants. He led him over to a counter and took Sherman's fingers one by one and pressed them into an ink pad and then rolled them onto a printed form. It was a surprisingly rough operation. He gripped each of Sherman's fingers as if he were picking up a knife or a hammer and plunged it into the ink pad. Then he apologized.
"You have to do all the work yourself," he said to Sherman. "You can't expect nobody comes in here to lift a goddamn finger for you."
From across the corridor came the furious sound of someone retching. Three of the Latins were at the bars of the pen.
"Hey!" yelled one of them. "The man puking! He puking plenty!"
Tanooch was the first policeman there.
"Oh, for Christ's sake! Ah, oh, beautiful! Hey, Angel! This guy's a one-man garbage barge! What do you want to do?"
"He the same one?" said the Angel.
Then the smell of vomit began to spread.
"Hey, what are you? Said the Angel. "Hose it down and leave him in there."
They opened the bars, and two policemen stood by outside while a third went inside with a hose. The prisoners hopped this way and that to keep from getting wet.
"Hey, Sarge," said the policeman. "Guy puked all over his pants." "The fatigues?" "Yeah. Fuck it. Hose him down. This ain't a laundry."
Sherman could see the tall man sitting on the ledge with his head down. His knees were covered in vomit, and his elbows were on his knees. The big man was watching all this through the window of the fingerprint room. He was shaking his head. Sherman went up to him.
"Look, officer, isn't there some other place I can wait? I can't go in there. I just can't do it."
The big man stuck his head out of the fingerprint room and yelled,
"Hey, Angel, what do you want to do with my man here, McCoy?"
The Angel looked over from his desk and stared at Sherman and rubbed his hand over his bald head.
"Well," then he motioned with his hand toward the cell. "That's it."
Tanooch came in and took Sherman by the arm again. Someone opened up the bars. Tanooch steered Sherman inside, and he went shuffling onto the tile floor, holding up his pants. The bars shut behind him. Sherman stared at the Latins, who were sitting on the ledge. They stared back, all but the tall one, who still had his head down, rolling his elbows in the vomit on his knees. The entire floor slanted in toward the drain in the middle. It was still wet. Sherman could feel the slant now that he was standing on it. A few driblets of water were still rolling down the drain. That was it. It was a drain pipe, where mankind sought its own level, and the meat spigot was on. He heard the bars slide shut behind him, and he stood there in the cell, holding his pants up with his right hand. He cradled his jacket with his left arm. He didn't know what to do or even where to look, and so he picked out an empty space on the wall and tried to take a look at them with peripheral vision. Their clothes were a blur of gray and black and brown, except for their sneakers, which created a pattern of stripes and swashes along the floor. He knew they were watching him. He glanced toward the bars. Not a single policeman. Would they even move a muscle, if anything? The Latinos had taken over every seat on the ledge. He chose a spot about 4 feet from the end of the ledge and leaned his back against the wall. The wall hurt his spine. He lifted his right foot and his shoe fell off. He slipped his foot back into it as casually as he could. Looking down at his foot on the bright tile made him feel as if he was going to keel over with vertigo. The styrofoam peanuts, they were still all over his pants legs. He was seized with the terrible fear that they would take him to be a lunatic, the sort of hopeless case they could slaughter at their leisure. He was aware of the smell of vomit, vomit and cigarette smoke. He lowered his head as if he were dozing and cut his eyes toward them. They were staring at him. They were staring at him and smoking their cigarettes. The tall one, the one who had kept saying, "Mira, mira," still sat on the ledge with his head down and his elbows on his knees, which were covered in vomit. One of the Latinos was rising up from the ledge and walking toward him. He could see him out of the corner of his eye. Now it was starting. They weren't even waiting. The man was settling up against the wall right next to him, leaning back the same way Sherman was. He had thin, curly hair, a mustache that curved down around his lips, a slightly yellowish complexion, narrow shoulders, a little pot belly, and a crazy look in his eyes. He must have been about 35. He smiled, and that made him look crazier still.
"Hi, mate. I see you outside."
"See me outside?"
"With the TV, mate. Why you here?"
"Reckless endangerment," said Sherman.
He felt as if he were croaking out his last words on this earth.
"Reckless endangerment?"
"That's hitting somebody with your car."
"With your car? You hit somebody with your car and the TV come here?"
Sherman shrugged. He didn't want to say anything more, but his fear of appearing aloof got the better of him.
"What are you here for?"
"Oh, man, 220, 265, 225.
The fellow threw his hand out, as if to take in the entire world.
"Drugs, handguns, gambling paraphernalia, every piece of bullshit, you know?"
The man seemed to take a certain pride in this calamity.
"You hit somebody with your car?"
he asked once more. He apparently found this trivial and unmanly. Sherman raised his eyebrows and nodded wearily. The man returned to the seating ledge, and Sherman could see him talking to three or four of his comrades, who looked at Sherman once more and then looked away, as if bored by the news. Sherman had the feeling that he had let them down. Very odd. And yet that was what he felt. Sherman's fear was rapidly supplanted by tedium. The minutes crawled by. His left hip joint began to hurt. He shifted his weight to the right and his back hurt. Then his right hip joint hurt. The floor was tile. The walls were tile. He rolled up his jacket to create a cushion. He put it on the floor next to the wall and sat down and leaned back. The jacket was damp, and so were his pants. His bladder was beginning to fill, and he could feel little knives of gas in his bowels. The little man who had come over to talk to him, the little man who knew the numbers, walked to the bars. He had a cigarette in his mouth. He took the cigarette out and he yelled,
"Hey, I need a light."
No response from the policeman beyond.
"Hey, I need a light."
Finally, the one called Tanooch came up.
"What's your problem?"
I need a light."
He held up his cigarette. Tanooch dug a book of matches out of his pocket and lit one and held it about 4 feet away from the bars. The little man waited, then put the cigarette between his lips and pressed his face against the bars so that the cigarette protruded outside. Tanooch was motionless, holding the burning match. The match went out.
"Aye,"
said the little man. Tanooch shrugged and let the match fall to the floor.
"Aye,"
The little man turned around toward his comrades and held the cigarette up in the air. See what he did? One of the men sitting on the ledge laughed. The little man made a face at this betrayal of sympathies. Then he looked at Sherman. Sherman didn't know whether to commiserate or look the other way. He ended up just staring. The man walked over and squatted down beside him. The unlit cigarette was hanging out of his mouth.
"Just see that?"
he asked.
"Yes," said Sherman. "You want a light? They supposed to give you a light. Son of a bitch. Hey, you got cigarettes?"
"No, they took everything away from me, even my shoestrings."
"No shit."
He looked at Sherman's shoes. He himself still had on shoelaces, Sherman noticed. Sherman could hear a woman's voice. She was angry about something. She appeared in the little corridor outside the cell. Tanuch was leading her. She was a tall, thin woman with curly brown hair and dark, tan skin. Wearing black pants and an odd-looking jacket with very big shoulders, Tanuch was escorting her toward the fingerprint room. All at once, she wheeled about and said to someone Sherman couldn't see,
"You big bagger!"
She didn't complete the phrase.
"Least I don't sit in this sewer here all day long while you do. Think about it, fat boy."
Much derisive laughter from the policeman in the background.
"Watch it or he'll flush you down, Mabel," Tanuch prodded her on.
"Come on, Mabel."
She turned on Tanuch.
"You talk to me, you call me by my right name. You don't call me Mabel."
Tanuch said,
"I'll call you worse than that in a minute."
And he kept pushing her on toward the fingerprint room.
22031, said the little man.
"Selling drugs."
"How do you know?" asked Sherman. The little man just opened his eyes wide and put a knowing look on his face.
Some things go without saying.
Then he shook his head and said,
"Fucking bus come in."
"Bus?"
It seemed that ordinarily, when people were arrested, they were taken first to a precinct station house and locked up. Periodically, a police van made the rounds of the precincts and transported the prisoners to central booking for fingerprinting and arraignment. So now a new lot had arrived. They would all end up in this pen, except for the women, who were taken to another pen down the corridor and around a bend. And nothing was moving, because Albany was down. Three more women went by. They were younger than the first one.
230,
said the little man.
"Prostitutes."
The little man who knew the numbers was right. The bus had come in. The procession began, from the angel's desk to the fingerprinting room to the cell. Sherman's pang of fear began to heat up all over again. One by one, three tall black youths with shaved heads, windbreakers, and big white sneakers came into the cell. All of the new arrivals were black or Latin. Most were young. Several appeared to be drunk. The little man who knew the numbers got up and went back to join his comrades and secure his place on the ledge. Sherman was determined not to move. He wanted to be invisible. Somehow, so long as he didn't move a muscle, they wouldn't see him. Sherman stared at the floor and tried not to think about his aching bowels and bladder. One of the black lines between the tiles on the floor began to move. A cockroach. Then he saw another, and a third. Fascinating. And horrible. Sherman glanced about to see if anyone else noticed. No one seemed to. But he caught the eye of one of the three black youths. All three were staring at him. Such thin, hard, malevolent faces. His heart immediately kicked into tachycardia. He could see his foot jerk with the force of his heartbeat pulse. He stared at the cockroaches to try to cool himself down. A cockroach had made its way over to the drunken Latino who had slumped to the floor. The cockroach began ascending the heel of his shoe. It began walking up his leg. It disappeared up his pant leg. Then it reappeared. It climbed the cuff of his pants. It began climbing toward his knee. When it reached the knee, it settled in amid the cakes of vomit. Sherman looked up. One of the black youths was heading toward him. He had a little smile on his face. He seemed tremendously tall. His eyes were set close together. He wore black pants with stovepipe legs and big white sneakers that closed in front with Velcro straps rather than shoelaces. He stooped down in front of Sherman. His face had no expression at all the more terrifying. He looked right into Sherman's face.
"Hey, man, you got a cigarette?"
Sherman said, "No." But he didn't want him to think he was acting tough or even uncommunicative, so he added, "Sorry, they took everything away from me." As soon as he said it, he knew it was a mistake. It was an apology, a signal that he was weak.
"That's okay, man."
The youth sounded halfway friendly.
"What you in for?"
Sherman hesitated. "Manslaughter," he said. Reckless endangerment just wasn't enough.
"Yeah, that's bad,"
said the youth in an approximation of a concerned voice.
"What happened?"
"Nothing," said Sherman. "I don't know what they're talking about. What are you here for?"
"A 16015, said the youth.
Then he added,
"Armed robbery."
The youth screwed up his lips. Sherman couldn't tell whether that was supposed to say, "Armed robbery is nothing special," or, "It's a bullshit charge." The youth smiled at Sherman, still looking directly into his face.
"Okay, Mr. Manslaughter,"
he said, and he stood up and turned about and walked back to the other side of the cell. "Mr. Manslaughter, immediately he knew he could treat me cavalierly. What could they do? Surely they couldn't. There had been an incident where, in which some of the prisoners in a cell blocked the view through the bars with their bodies while the others... But would any of the others in here do such a thing for these three... Would the Latinos? Sherman's mouth was dry, absolutely parched. The urge to urinate was acute. His heart beat nervously, although not as rapidly as before. At that moment, the bars slid open. More policemen. One of them carried two cardboard trays, the sort delicatessens use. He set them down on the floor of the cell. On one was a mound of sandwiches, on the other rows of plastic cups. He stood up and said,
"Okay, chow time. Share and share alike, and I don't want to hear any bullshit."
There was no rush toward the food. All the same, Sherman was glad he was not too far away from the two trays. He tucked his filthy jacket under his left arm and shuffled over and picked up a sandwich wrapped in saran wrap and a plastic cup containing a clear, pinkish liquid. Then he sat down in his coat again and tried the drink. It had a weak, sugary taste. He put the plastic cup on the floor beside him and pulled the wrap off the sandwich. He pulled the two pieces of bread apart and peeked inside. There was a slice of lunch meat. It was a sickly yellowish color. In the fluorescent light of the cell, it looked almost chartreuse. It had a smooth, clammy surface. He raised the sandwich toward his face and sniffed. A dead chemical smell came from the meat. He separated the two pieces of bread and pulled out the piece of meat and wrapped it up in the saran wrap and put the crumpled mess on the floor. He would eat the bread by itself. But the bread gave off such an unpleasant smell from the meat he couldn't stand it. Laboriously, he unfolded the saran wrap and rolled up the bread into balls and wrapped up the whole mess, the meat and the bread. He was aware of someone standing in front of him. White sneakers with Velcro straps. He looked up. The black youth was looking down at him with a curious little smile. He sank down on his haunches until his head was only slightly above Sherman's.
"Hey, man," he said. "I'm kind of thirsty. Give me a drink."
"Give me your drink." Sherman nodded toward the cardboard trays.
"Ain't none left, man. Give me yours."
Sherman ransacked his mind for something to say. He shook his head.
"You heard the man. Share and share alike. Thought me and you's buddies."
Such a contemptuous tone of mock disappointment. Sherman knew it was time to draw a line, stop this, Quicker than Sherman's eye could follow it, the youth's arm shot out and seized the plastic cup on the floor beside Sherman. He stood up and threw back his head and ostentatiously drained the drink and held the cup over Sherman and said,
"I asked you politely, you understand? In here you gotta use your head and make friends."
Then he opened his hand, let the cup fall down onto Sherman's lap, and walked away. Sherman was aware the entire room was watching. I should... But he was paralyzed with fear and confusion. Across the way, a Latino was pulling the meat out of his sandwich and throwing it on the floor. There were slices of meat everywhere. Here and there were balled-up wads of saran wrap and entire sandwiches, unwrapped and thrown on the floor. The Latino had begun to eat the bread by itself, and his eyes were on Sherman. They were looking at him, in this human pen. Yellow lunch meat, bread, saran wrap, plastic cups, cockroaches. Here, over there. He looked toward the drunken Latino. He was still collapsed on the floor. There were three cockroaches rooting about in the folds of his left pant leg at the knee. All at once, Sherman saw something moving at the mouth of the man's pant pocket. Another roach. No, much too big, gray. A mouse. A mouse crawling out of the man's pocket. The mouse clung to the cloth for a moment, then scampered down to the tile floor and stopped again. Then it darted forward and reached a piece of yellow lunch meat. It stopped again, as if sizing up this bonanza.
"Mira!"
One of the Latinos had seen the mouse. A foot came flying out from the ledge. The mouse went skidding across the tile floor like a hockey puck. Another leg flew out. The mouse went flying back toward the ledge. A laugh, a cackle.
"Mira!"
Another foot. The mouse went skidding on its back over a wad of lunch meat, which spun it upright again. Laughter, shouts.
"Mira! Mira!"
Another kick. The mouse came spinning toward Sherman on its back. It was just lying there, 2 or 3 inches from his foot, dazed, its legs jerking. Then it struggled to its feet, barely moving. The little rodent was out of it, finished. Not even fear was enough to get it moving. It lurched forward a couple of steps. More laughter. Should I kick it as a sign of my solidarity with my cellmates? That was what he wondered. Without thinking, he stood up. He reached down and picked up the mouse. He held it in his right hand and walked toward the bars. The cell grew silent. The mouse twitched feebly in his palm. He had almost reached the bars.
"Son of a bitch!"
A tremendous pain in his index finger. The mouse had bitten him. Sherman jumped and jerked his hand up. The mouse held onto his finger with its jaws. Sherman flailed his finger up and down as if he were shaking down a thermometer. The little beast wouldn't let go.
"Mira, mira!"
Cackles, laughter. It was a terrific show. They were enjoying it immensely. Sherman banged the meaty side of his hand down on one of the cross pieces of the bars. The mouse went flying off, right in front of Tanooch, who had a sheaf of papers in his hand and was approaching the cell. Tanooch jumped back.
"Holy shit!"
he said. Then he glowered at Sherman.
"You gone off the platter?"
The mouse was lying on the floor. Tanooch stamped on it with the heel of his shoe. The animal lay flattened on the floor with its mouth open. Sherman's hand hurt terribly from where he had hit the bar. He cradled it with his other hand. "I've broken it." He could see the teeth marks of the mouse on his index finger and a single tiny blob of blood. With his left hand, he reached around behind his back and pulled the handkerchief out of his right hip pocket. It required a tremendous contortion. They were all watching. Oh, yes, all watching. He swabbed the blood and wrapped the handkerchief around his hand. He heard Tanooch say to another policeman, "The guy from Park Avenue, he threw a mouse." Sherman shuffled back toward where his jacket was balled up on the floor. He sat back down on the coat. His hand didn't hurt nearly so much any longer. Maybe I haven't broken it, but my finger may be poisoned from the bite. He pulled the handkerchief back far enough to look at the finger. It didn't look so bad. The blob of blood was gone. The black youth was coming toward him again. Sherman looked up at him and then looked away. The fellow sat on his haunches in front of him, as before.
"Hey, man," he said. "You know something? I'm cold."
Sherman tried to ignore him. He turned his head. He was conscious of having a petulant look on his face. The wrong expression. Weak.
"Yo, look at me when I'm talking to you."
Sherman turned his head toward him. Pure malevolence.
"I asked you for a drink and you wasn't nice, but I'm going to give you a chance to make up for that. See? I'm feeling cold, man. I want your coat. Give me a coat."
"My coat? My clothes?" Sherman's mind raced. He couldn't speak. He shook his head no.
"What's the matter with you, man? You ought to try and be friendly, Mr. Manslaughter. My buddy, he say he know you. He saw you on TV. You wasted some ace and you live on Park Avenue. That's nice, man, but this ain't Park Avenue. You understand? You best be making some friends, you understand? You've been slicking me some kind of bad, but I'm going to give you a chance to make up for it. Now give me the fucking coat."
Sherman stopped thinking. His brain was on fire. He put his hands flat on the floor and lifted his hips and then rocked forward until he was on one knee. Then he jumped up, clutching the jacket in his right hand. He did it so suddenly the black youth was startled.
"Shut up," he heard himself saying. "You and I got nothing to talk about."
The black youth stared at him blankly. Then he smiled.
"Shut up," he said. "Shut up?"
He grinned and made a snorting noise.
"Shut me up."
"Hey, you germs, knock it off."
It was Tanooch at the bars. He was looking at the two of them. The black youth gave Sherman a big smile and stuck his tongue in his cheek. "Enjoy yourself. You're going to own your mortal hide for about 60 seconds longer." He walked back to the ledge and sat down, staring at Sherman the whole time. Tanooch read from a sheet of paper.
"Salinas, Gutierrez, McCoy."
"McCoy." Sherman hurriedly put on the jacket, lest his nemesis rush forward and snatch it before he could leave the cell. The jacket was wet, greasy, fetid, completely shapeless. His pants fell down around his hips as he put it on. There were styrofoam peanuts all over the coat and... moving! Two cockroaches had crawled into the folds. Frantically, he swept them off onto the floor. He was still breathing rapidly and loudly. As Sherman filed out of the cell behind the Latinos, Tanooch said to him in a low voice,
"See, we didn't forget you. Your name's actually about 6 more down the list."
"Thank you," said Sherman. "I appreciate that." Tanooch shrugged.
"I'd rather walk you out of there than sweep you out of there."
The main room was now full of policemen and prisoners. At the desk, the Angel's desk, Sherman was turned over to a Department of Corrections officer who manacled his hands behind his back and put him in a line with the Latinos. His pants now fell hopelessly around his hips. There was no way he could pull them up. He kept looking over his shoulder, fearful that the black youth might be right behind him. He was the last person in the little line. The corrections officers led them up a narrow stairway. At the top of the stairs was another windowless room. More corrections officers sat at some beat-up metal desks. Beyond the desks, more cells. They were smaller, grayer, dingier than the white tile cells downstairs. Real jail cells they were. On the first was a peeling sign that said, "Men only, 21 and over, 8 to 10 cap." The 21 and over had been crossed out with some sort of marker. The entire line of prisoners was led into the cell. The handcuffs were left on. Sherman kept his eyes pinned on the doorway they had first entered. If the black youth came in and was put into this small cell with him, his fear made him crazy. He was sweating profusely. He had lost all track of time. He hung his head down to try to improve his circulation. Presently, they were led out of the cell and toward a door made of steel bars. On the other side of the door, Sherman could see a line of prisoners sitting on the floor of a corridor. The corridor was scarcely 36 inches wide. One of the prisoners was a young white man with an enormous cast on his right leg. He wore shorts so that the entire cast was visible. He was sitting on the floor. A pair of crutches leaned against the wall beside him. At the far end of the corridor was a door. An officer stood beside it. He had a huge revolver on his hip. It occurred to Sherman that this was the first gun he had seen since he entered this place. As each prisoner left the detention area and went through the gate, his handcuffs were removed. Sherman slumped against the wall like all the rest. The corridor was airless. There were no windows. It was filled with a fluorescent haze and the heat and stench of too many bodies. The meat spigot. The chute to the abattoir. Going where? The door at the end of the corridor opened, and a voice from the other side said,
"Lantier!"
The corrections officer inside the corridor said,
"Okay, Lantier."
The young man with the crutches struggled to his feet. The Latino next to him gave him a hand. He bounced on his good foot until he could get the crutches settled under his armpits. What on earth could he have done in that condition? The policeman opened the door for him, and Sherman could hear a voice on the other side calling out some numbers and then,
"Herbert Lantier? Counsel representing Herbert Lantier?"
The courtroom. At the end of the chute was the courtroom. By the time Sherman's turn came, he felt dazed, groggy, feverish. The voice from the other side said,
"Sherman McCoy."
The policeman inside said,
"McCoy."
Sherman shuffled through the door, holding his pants up, sliding his feet so as to keep his shoes on. He was aware of a bright, modern room and a great many people going this way and that. The judge's bench, the desks, the seats were all made of a cheap-looking blonde wood. To one side, people moved in waves around the judge's elevated blonde wood perch. And on the other side, they moved in waves in what appeared to be a spectator section. So many people, such a bright light, such confusion, such a commotion. Between the two sections was a fence, also of blonde wood, and at the fence stood Killian. He was there. He looked very fresh and dapper in his fancy clothes. He was smiling. It was the reassuring smile you save for invalids. As Sherman shuffled toward him, he became acutely aware of what he himself must look like. The filthy, sodden jacket and pants, the styrofoam peanuts, the wrinkled shirt, the wet shoes with no strings. He could smell his own funk of filth, despair, and terror. Someone was reading out some number, and then he heard his name, and then he heard Killian saying his own name, and the judge said,
"How do you plead?"
Killian said to Sherman, sotto voce,
"Say, not guilty."
Sherman croaked out the words. There seemed to be a great deal of commotion in the room. The press? How long had he been in this place? Then an argument broke out. There was an intense, heavy-set, balding young man in front of the judge. He seemed to be from the district attorney's office. The judge said, "Buzz, buzz, 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 Mr. Kramer." Mr. Kramer. To Sherman, the judge seemed very young. He was a chubby white man with receding curly hair and a set of robes that looked as if they had been rented for a graduation. Sherman heard Killian mutter,
"Son of a bitch."
Kramer was saying, "I realize, Your Honor, that our office agreed to bail of only $10,000 in this case, but subsequent developments, matters that have come to our attention since that time, make it impossible for our office to agree to such a low bail. Your Honor, this case involves a serious injury, very possibly a fatal injury, and we have definite and specific knowledge that there was a witness in this case who has not come forward, and that that witness was actually in the car driven by the defendant, Mr. McCoy, and we have every reason to believe that attempts have been or will be made to prevent that witness from coming forth, and we do not believe it will serve the interests of justice, Killian said, Your Honor, to allow the defendant to go free on a token bail. A rumble, a growl, an immense angry mutter rose from the spectators' section, and a single deep voice shouted, No bail! Then a mighty mutterer's chorus, No bail! Lock him up! Bang it shut! The judge rapped his gavel. The muttering died down. Killian said, Your Honor, Mr. Kramer knows very well. The rumble rose again. Kramer plowed on right over Killian's words. Given the emotions in this community quite justifiably aroused by this case, in which it has appeared that justice is a reed, Killian on the counterattack, shouting, Your Honor, this is patent nonsense! A mighty rumble. The rumble erupted into a roar, the muttering into a great raw yawp. Aw, man! Boo! Yeah!
Shut your filthy mouth and let the man talk!
The judge banged the gavel again.
Quiet!
The roar subsided. Then to Killian, Let him finish his statement. You can respond. Thank you, Your Honor, said Kramer. Your Honor, I would call the court's attention to the fact that this case, even in the arraignment stage, on very short notice, has brought out a heavy representation of the community, and most specifically of the friends and neighbors of the victim in this case, Henry Lamb, who remains in extremely grave condition in the hospital. Kramer turned and motioned toward the spectators' section. It was packed. There were people standing. Sherman noticed a group of black men in blue work shirts. One of them was very tall and wore a gold earring. I have a petition, said Kramer, and he lifted some sheets of paper and waved them over his head. This document has been signed by more than 100 members of the community and delivered to the Bronx District Attorney's Office with an appeal that our office be their representative to see that justice is done in this case, and of course it is no more than our sworn duty to be their representative.
Jesus H. Christ, muttered Killian.
The neighborhood, the community, the people of the Bronx intend to watch this case diligently, every step of the judicial process.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Tell him.
A terrific yammering started in the spectator section. The chubby judge rapped his gavel and called out,
Quiet. This is an arraignment. It's not a rally.
Is that all, Mr. Kramer? Rumble, rumble, mutter, mutter, boo. Your Honor, said Kramer, I have been instructed by my office, by Mr. Weiss himself, to request bail in the amount of $250,000 in this case.
Right, yeah, tell him!
Cheers, applause, stamping on the floor. Sherman looked at Killian. Tell me this can't possibly happen. But Killian was straining toward the judge. He had his hand in the air. His lips were already moving. The judge was banging the gavel.
Any more of this and I'll clear the room.
Your Honor, said Killian as the din subsided. Mr. Kramer is not content to violate an agreement between his office and my client. He wants his circus. This morning, my client was subjected to a circus arrest, despite the fact that he has been ready at all times to testify voluntarily before a grand jury. And now Mr. Kramer manufactures a fictitious threat to an unnamed witness and asks the court to set a preposterous bail. My client is a homeowner of long standing in this city. He has a family and deep roots in his community, and a bail request has been agreed to, as even Mr. Kramer acknowledges, and nothing has occurred to alter the premise of that agreement.
A lot has changed, Your Honor, said Kramer.
Yeah, said Killian.
The office of the Bronx District Attorney is what's changed.
All right, said the judge. Mr. Kramer, if your office has information bearing upon the bail status of this case, I instruct you to gather that information and make a formal application to this court, and the matter will be reviewed at that time. Until then, the court is releasing the defendant Sherman McCoy under a bond in the amount of $10,000 pending presentation of this complaint to the grand jury. Bellows and screams, "Boo! Yeah! No! Get him!" And then a chant began. "No bail, put him in jail. No bail, put him in jail." Killian was leading him away from the bench. To get out of the courtroom, they would have to go straight through the spectators section, straight through a mass of angry people who were now on their feet. Sherman could see 50.